So the price of peanut butter may not be peanuts very much longer. It's going up. A record drought plus high prices for other crops are part of the reason. Josephine Bennett from Georgia Public Broadcasting has the story.
It's lunchtime at the Barber Home in Macon, Georgia. Three-year-old Samuel has just gotten up from his nap, and he's hungry.
Do you want to come up here and help me make a sandwich? Do you like the crunchy or the creamy?
The creamy. Yeah.
Carol Barber says Samuel eats peanut butter for lunch almost every day, and he's not the only one. She has three other little boys. She says it's been one of her go-to foods during this economic downturn.
We're always looking for things on sale. We are usually looking for non-name brand things. We try to find the biggest bang for our buck, especially in terms of feeding a family of six.
But that's getting harder to do. And to find out why, you don't need to look any further than Benny Johnston's farm, 100 miles away in Osceola. A peanut combine lumbers over the neat rows, picking and separating the pods from the vine. Mounds of peanuts are dug up and dry in the sun. The good peanuts travel up a conveyor and into a bin. Benny Johnston is 73 and has been farming since he was 16.
How is this year different than years past?
Well, it's been a trying year. We had so much hardship starting off with no moisture and all we had to contend with. And then the heat, excessive heat, we think hurt us a lot.
But Johnston considers himself lucky. This year's long, hot drought pummeled farmers, but he has an irrigation system. University of Georgia peanut agronomist John Beasley says without irrigation, many farmers would have no crop at all.
Unfortunately, I have walked some fields in this state this year that are going to end up with zero yield.
And this is a problem for consumers because almost three-quarters of the Georgia harvest is used to make peanut butter. The cost of peanuts has already doubled. To add to the problem, Don Kaler with the Georgia Peanut Commission says farmers planted more cotton and corn this season. Some farmers still hope for the best. Armand Morris stands in his empty field as a tractor pulls bins of peanuts to a nearby shelling facility.
So far as the peanut butter on the shelves, candy bars, peanut products on the shift, but it's going to be tight.
And tight for consumers, too. Parent Carol Barber says if peanut butter prices get much higher, she may cut back and buy a lot less of one of her family's favorite foods. For NPR News, I'm Josephine Bennett in Macon, Georgia.
This is NPR News.
There's an unfamiliar trend emerging in America's troubled housing market. Big banks are volunteering to lose money, hundreds of millions of dollars, in order to save homes at risk of foreclosure. NPR's Arthi Shahani reports on how this solution gained traction in Boston and why it's going national.
Well, welcome to my house. You know, we do have a doorbell.
Sharon Jordan begins a tour of her three-story duplex. It's on the verge of foreclosure.
This is my living room, nice and quaint as it is. And this is my mother.
She's pointing to a picture on the mantle. Sheila Mae Jordan died last year. She was a nurse. In 2006, she bought the family's first ever house here in Dorchester. Sharon Jordan was sorting through her mom's boxes when she stumbled across letters from Bank of America. Turns out mom stopped paying the mortgage after a heart attack. Jordan called the bank immediately.
Is there any way that you all can help me, help myself? Because I don't want to lose the home. We worked too hard to get it. I don't want to lose it.
Her mom bought the house for $521,000. Then the housing bubble burst. Now it's worth half that. Jordan told Bank of America,
sell it to me and I'll buy it from you, but I don't want to buy it at that price.
She wanted 50% off. That's what it's worth. And that would cut monthly mortgage payments in half. Her solution is called a principal write-down. Bank of America said no. Elise Cherry took that no for a maybe. She's the CEO of a nonprofit group called Boston Community Capital. Cherry knew the bubble would burst well before it happened.
What we saw were housing prices skyrocketing even though incomes were flat. We had a hairdresser come in who made an annual income of $23,000. She had a mortgage of $325,000.
Housing prices have plunged back down to earth. Cherry says it's time to match affordable homes with people who can actually afford them. That's her business, in fact. Boston Community Capital runs an investment fund. Cherry's going to the major banks with an offer.
You sell everything that you've got at current market prices so that you clear your books, you take your losses, and then you, as a healthier lender, can go back out and lend some more.
Boston Community Capital is willing to buy the most distressed homes at the going rate and take on the risk of reselling to homeowners like Jordan. The nonprofit actually makes some money by selling at a slight markup. In a foreclosure, banks make nothing. Worse yet, they lose in missed mortgage payments, taxes, insurance, eviction fees. Cherry's appeal is simple.
We can reduce your costs.
Bank of America was the first to bite. They launched a pilot project with the nonprofit.
We think this is a very good test and concept.
That's Rebecca Marone. She leads efforts at Bank of America to help delinquent customers keep their homes. That job description might sound ironic. Bank of America just settled a $335 million lawsuit for unfair practices related to its countrywide unit. It's the largest settlement for housing discrimination in American history. A few months ago, the bank mailed distressed borrowers with good news. They could apply to sell and rebuy their homes. A Boston nonprofit would help them. The solution isn't perfect. Some bank execs and investors are concerned that homeowners will default on payments, strategic defaults, just to get the benefit of a cheaper house. But Marone says that fear is overblown.
In most cases, what we see is real hardship. People want to stay in their homes, they continue to pay, and they don't want their credit to be severely impacted as it is when a consumer stops paying their mortgage or other debt.
Turns out, other banks agree. 2011 closed with a new trend. In 30% of private loan modifications, banks are doing a principal write-down, that is, hacking away at the amount owed. 2 years ago, that 30% was just at 2%. Lori Goodman welcomes the shift. Her firm, Amherst Securities, sells mortgage-backed securities to investors. Even though her own clients stand to lose millions, they lose millions more with foreclosures.
Most investors understand the fact that they're better off. I actually found it very, very encouraging.
Encouraging, she says, because it's overdue housekeeping for America's economy. Banks clear their balance sheets, investors get a predictable stream of income, and homeowners stay homeowners, like Sharon Jordan. She's among the first participants in the Boston pilot project.
I'm nervous. I'm nervous, but I can do this.
She's just handed in her first down payment. Aarti Shahani, NPR News.
Most U.S. manufacturing came back strongly this year. Nowhere was that more evident than across the Midwest. But even if it was a good year for industry, not all of the jobs lost during the recent recession returned. Nyla Boudou of Changing Gears has the story for our series, A Good Year.
Chicago White Metal Casting's CEO Eric Treiber is leading me onto his factory floor, where workers are busy making small aluminum, zinc, and magnesium metal parts.
Oh, they're making parts that'll go into cars, some parts that'll be used for a swimming pool. We're making components that'll go onto some farm equipment.
It's a whole lot louder in here than it was a few years ago. Revenue's up 4% over 2010, which reflected an increase from 2009. Those numbers are being repeated at factories across the Midwest.
We're seeing a great demand for some of the machinery that's made right here in the Midwest.
That's Bill Strauss, a senior economist with the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. He's talking about not just small parts, but cars, tractors, mining equipment, and steel. As the Fed measures it, Midwestern manufacturing has enjoyed 28 months of growth at rates much better than the national average and the overall economy.
The kind of goods that we produce here are very high value-added goods. You know, we have the Caterpillar 797B made here in the state of Illinois. It's the largest truck made in the world, weighing over 1 million pounds, costing, you know, a neighborhood of $7-8 million.
Imagine how much steel goes into that. So with all those orders, where are the jobs? During the recession, one out of every four jobs lost was in manufacturing. That's 2.3 million jobs. As of last November, though, just 308,000 had returned. Why so few? Remember the mantra, produce more with less? Many manufacturers practically perfected that during this recession. Take Chicago White Metal Casting. Treiber says they had to be focused on productivity in order to keep up with overseas competition. So they updated machines, focused on staff training, and improved quality control. And Triber is actually hiring, but he's looking for specialists like die-cast machinists. And that's the problem right now with manufacturing. With better productivity, the need is for more skilled workers. Not just machinists, but welders, designers, and most of all, people who know how to operate the new computerized machines on factory floors, CNC workers. Economist Bill Strauss.
What about the 2 million that lost jobs? Can't you hire those back? And what you find out from people is that even though they were classified as being in manufacturing, many of them lack the kind of skills that are required in this more 21st century manufacturing.
Strauss says he's optimistic that the manufacturing sector will continue to do well in the coming year. But he also says it will need more workers who have the exact skills needed to do the new jobs. For NPR News, I'm Nyla Boodoo in Chicago.
This is NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. It's been almost a year since we launched our series, The Road Back to Work. We've followed six people in St. Louis who started 2011 unemployed and searching for work. They came from different backgrounds and different industries. What they shared was the struggle to find a job in this challenging economy. Ultimately, they all returned to work. But as NPR's Tamara Keith reports, keeping a job in this economy can be every bit as tough as finding one.
Randy Howland spent most of this past year working at a $10 an hour customer service job. He used to make six figures. With this job, he was settling, just so he could have the satisfaction of working. It was essentially a call center job. At times, Howland struggled with the pace, taking too long on the calls, because he says he wanted to make sure the customers were happy. So it wasn't entirely a surprise when Howland got a call from his boss.
My boss just said I was on the list to be cut, and that was it.
All year long, Howland and the others have been using a small digital recorder to document their job situations. It takes him a few days to get around to recording this update.
Well, it's Saturday the 27th of August. This is Randy. And I got laid off. So back where we started.
He brought back out his job search spreadsheet, documenting every application, every contact, every interview.
September 14th, I'm at the Hilton Hotel. No, not on a vacation. I'm at another job fair. October 20th. I had a second interview with a company, a position that I really, really, really would like. Okay, November 3rd, 2011. Yep, on my way to another interview.
And then, after 2.5 months of searching.
Monday the 7th, 104 Central. This is Randy, and just got a job offer, and I took that job offer.
It's with a company called Express Scripts. They help companies and government agencies manage health benefits, specifically prescription drugs. Howland will be doing customer service, and he's excited about the company's emphasis on customer satisfaction.
Is it still a third of what I made about 10 years ago? Yeah, but it's also 30% higher than I was just making at a job I wasn't too thrilled with. So it's a good day.
Howland isn't the only one on the road back to work to lose a job. The Barfields, Brian and Jennifer, who met in a networking group for unemployed professionals, both had temp positions earlier this year. In September, Brian was let go. Then, in November, it was Jennifer's turn. She turns on a recorder as she drives home at 3:30 in the afternoon on a Friday. She had a meeting with her boss at 3.
I'm sure you can surmise what has happened. Today was my 7 month to the day anniversary, and I was let go. My boss basically said it wasn't working out.
Barfield was doing IT work. Now, both she and her husband Brian are essentially in the same unfortunate spot.
Brian is basically unemployed, and my job was holding us down. And I'm a little concerned of what the future holds.
She's afraid she may have to sell her engagement ring, or maybe the house.
I don't know. I never thought life would turn to this for me.
In 2010, there were 19 million people like the Barfields and Howland, who at times worked, but also experienced unemployment. Put another way, a whole lot of people know that feeling of having the rug pulled out from under them.
again.
Oh, Thanksgiving 2011. This is Randy. New job is going quite well. 2 weeks into my 5-week training. So far, everything's good. I got A's on everything except for one B so far.
There's a lot to learn, so new employees have to take tests. Howland is confident in a way he never was with his last job. He's upbeat and thinking about things he hasn't entertained in years.
We are considering taking advantage of employee benefits at my new job at Express Scripts.
It's been about a decade since Howland and his wife Lisa had health insurance. It either wasn't offered or was a luxury they couldn't afford. Less than a week later, before he even has a chance to sign up, Howland is let go after he failed to get 90% correct on a final exam.
We took it. I was still in the 80s. I don't know what I missed. I was just escorted to a room, told to turn in my information, and then escorted to the door.
He blames test anxiety. That Sunday, he's listening to country music in what's almost become a ritual after a job loss. He decides to write a letter to the company CEO, describing his situation.
Pleading for my job back and to help get our holidays back where we were feeling good about things. So it's a long shot, but boy, I really wanted this position.
Howland hasn't heard anything back yet. He's not even sure his letter will make it to the CEO. His job search is well underway again. Just this week, Jennifer Barfield started a new job at a law firm doing IT work. It's a lot like the job she lost more than 2 years ago, though with less pay. But she's still uneasy. She's learned the hard way. No job is forever. Tamara Keith, NPR News.